elves cast as slaves in the next production, faces blacked with burnt cork, holding the Queen's train at the rear of the stage. Such was the ruthless dictate of the house's reigning diva, Signorina Carlotta Castafiore. Yet, Christine Dye had a voice. Trilby O'Farrell had a face. And Irene Adler had a mind. When they arrived at the opera, the women were gems in the rough. To be revealed as diamonds of the first water, they required polish, cutting and careful setting. Without such treatment, they were likely to become dull pebbles, lost among so many other shingles on the beach. Many equally appealing young ladies have served years in the chorus, as their brothers served terms in the armed forces, or prison, trying not to squander meagre pay on absinthe or cards, hoping to emerge whole in mind and limb from regular ordeals, dreaming of comfortable retirement. At best, they might end up the second wives of comfortable widowers. At worst, they might... Well, at worst is too hideous to be dwelled upon, save to observe that such as they were, found ragged on the cobbles or drowned in the Seine with a frequency which verged upon the scandalous. These demoiselles tended to attract the puppy-like devotions of decent, dull-witted youths and the carnivorous attentions of indecent, cold-hearted roues. Our trio, in their private dreams, yearned for a different stripe of suitor, mysterious, dominating, challenging. Without such a presence in their lives, the girls lacked direction. But, even kept outside the circle of the limelight, they had an unnerving tendency to sparkle. Carlotta saw the shimmering in her wake and made sure they stayed in shadow. Nevertheless, one by one, they were noticed, not by the stuffy and harassed management or the violently partisan audience claques, but by a personage who saw into their secret selves. This unique individual was at once Christine's trapdoor lover, Trilby's mesmerist genius, and Irene's mastermind of intrigue. All Paris knew him as the opera ghost, though most deemed him a phantasm rather than a phantom. He was a bogey, conjured by stagehands to throw a scare into pretty little ballerinas, not the spectre of a dead man whose bones lay unshriven in a recess of Charles Garnier's palatial opera house. Those who had cause to believe the Phantom of the Opera, a man of flesh and bone, were wise enough not to speak of him. There were rumours about what happened to those who earned his displeasure. His protégés came to know him as Monsieur Eric. Among the Phantom's few intimates was the Persian. The exact function of this long-faced, astrakhan-capped fellow at the opera house was hard to determine, but evidently essential. The girls flitted through a surface world of upholstered finery, fashionable cafes and society engagements, of grand opening nights and merry madcap balls. The opera ghost confined himself to the decaying, watery labyrinth below street level, among the scenery of out-of-fashion productions and tombs of tortured men. Only the Persian passed easily between the two realms. It was said he was the only man living who had seen the true face behind mirror and mask, though some claimed to have glimpsed a yellow-eyed, noseless spectre in Box 5, upon which it had a permanent lease. From behind a mirror in Dressing Room 313, Eric gave music lessons, whispering for hours to his songbirds. His Swedish-born French nightingale, French-born Irish thrush, and all-American eagle. He first discovered Dye, his most naturally gifted pupil, and called from her a voice to rival the angels. Moreover, he taught her to feel the music, to imbue the polite perfection of her natural tones with the rude turbulence of her young heart. Thanks to Eric, Christine's voice could